Suchetta Real writes books about a cat. Her main character is named Beato, and he's a jet-setting, world-circling feline. Real is an author on a mission. Her books are part of a larger plan to raise cultural awareness for both kids and adults. Beato Goes to Indonesia just hit the shelves, and Suchetta joins us in the studio. Hi there.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
So as I understand it, this whole thing of Beato and the books began in your job in the finance industry because you became the resident foodie.
I did. I was the help desk when it came to any question involved food or travel at my desk. And then somebody suggested, why don't you just start a blog where people are not calling you 24 hours a day and they can just go to your website.
Right. You can say, they ask you a question, you say, check my blog. But this also actually began from your own personal life. You moved to Atlanta at the age of 17.
Correct.
And that can be a really tough time to move for a teenager. So how was that transition coming from India?
Yes, I moved from India to Atlanta. And for me, it was a great move because I'm a foodie. And in Atlanta, you can walk down the street and you can get food from all over the world. So needless to say, I gained 50 pounds in the first 3 months I was here.
You've clearly lost it. But since then, I mean, you have traveled all over the world on your own right.
Yes, I've been to 69 countries so far and have a score of going to at least 100 before I slow down.
Wow. So this Beato, the cat, when you decided to start writing books to encourage other people to travel, why a cat?
So a cat is non-denominational. He has no skin color, ethnicity, religion. He doesn't really identify with a particular ethnic group. And I thought, what better way to for an animal who's a cat who loves to explore? You know, cats are always curious. And he goes around the world and he meets these other children who act as his tour guide and show him the best of their country. And then this cat, he is my real life cat. So he's my companion as I'm writing. I work from home and I'm in the couch.
Your real life cat is named Beato?
Yes.
Which in Italian means?
It means happy or the blessed.
Yeah. So we have the very first Beato book. Where did he travel?
The first book, he went to Greenland. And you might ask, why Greenland?
I would ask that.
Because I did go to Greenland about 3 years ago. And I met this exceptional kid, 7-year-old girl called Ina. So all the characters are real in the book. This is exactly how she dressed and how she spoke and behaved. And she was my tour guide in her sheep farm, which is located 40 minutes away by boat from the nearest civilization. So we were at this farm where there are glaciers in the backyard. There's nothing but 200 sheep, her two dogs, her parents, and no other human beings. And she was taking me around. We would have picnics. We would run around. We'll lick ice off the glaciers. And it was just that, you know, kids live like that somewhere very close to United States. You know, Greenland is not that far, even if we think that it is. So I wanted to share that story with other kids around the world and show them the differences with each other's lifestyles.
And not surprisingly, a lot of your food, a lot of the books include the foods that Beato eats when he's there.
Yes.
He doesn't like all of them. What was Beato's, do you think, his favorite food he tried and his least favorite?
So he loves fish.
Yes.
Because he's a cat. He also likes olives. And my real life Beato also likes these things, so it's somewhat true. I don't know if he's always open to trying new things. You know, that's part of his curiosity. He's always tasting it something for the first time, even if he doesn't like it.
Uh-huh. But, okay, you don't have children of your own.
No.
You're quite young. So who is your reader? What kids do you put these books in front of to have them read it for you?
So I have neighbors, kids who are all under 10 years old. I have friends who have kids. I have nephews and nieces. And I have a lot of adults who actually love the books because they get to learn something new. If you scroll through the pages, you'll see every page has a new lesson that you may not know about. So how many pomegranates there are, how many pomegranate seeds in a full pomegranate, or what is a kimono dragon or what is a pygmy elephant. So, you know, every page has some interesting tidbit in a very lighthearted way with lots of graphics. And I have all ages of people who love these books.
So some of them are more complex than others. For example, he does travel to Israel. And it seems to me that you are very careful to make it educational only and keep it either above, I guess, the religious conflicts that go on there. How do you do that?
You're absolutely right. And some of the people, adults, have asked me that question, that how do you keep the differentiation about what's happening there and keep the all the not-so-beautiful aspect of the country out of the scene. And my response to that is I want to educate kids about the positive things of different culture. You know, this conflict may be here today. It may not be there tomorrow, but I want these books to stay forever. So if people just focus on the positive things of each country and learn about it and adapt them, I think the other things would be resolved much easier.
So in this current, the newest book, Beato Goes to Indonesia. So give us a tip about something, if I were to travel to Indonesia, that I would need to either eat or visit.
So if you go to Indonesia, I've been a few times. It is one of my favorite countries. I love the whole atmosphere of being one with nature, doing yoga every morning, watching the sunrise, hearing the birds, and seeing that every person, every family grows their own rice in their backyard, and the neighbors come to help each other in harvesting the rice twice a year. And that's all they eat. Every family would eat their own homegrown rice. And it tastes very different, as you'll see in Beato tasted some of the rice in the book, and he realizes that it is very different than store-bought rice.
Yeah, most fresh things are different. And so where is he going next?
So Beato is planning to go to Japan next. I just got back 2 weeks ago from a trip to Japan, and he was very inspired.
Well, he's going to be able to eat a lot of fish there, so yes. I imagine that's going to make him very happy. Suchetta Real writes books about a cat. Again, that cat is named Beato, and her newest book is called Beato Goes to Indonesia. She has a whole string of events coming up in Georgia, including a story time at the Little Shop of Stories in Decatur tonight.
Tonight at 7 o'clock.
Suchetta Real, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Celeste.
President Trump has created a commission to investigate voter fraud. Most states are refusing to hand over their registration records, but Georgia's leadership has agreed to release extensive personal information about voters here. Blogger Sam Burnham takes issue with that. He brings us this commentary.
I'm Sam Burnham, curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. I take issue with Georgia releasing its voter registration rules from a conservative small government view. First of all, it's as if the commission receiving these rolls was created by President Trump out of thin air, with no oversight from Congress, the courts, or the states. The next major issue is the role of the states. Our elections are run by the states, not federal entities, even if the offices being filled are federal. Local and state races do not involve the federal government. In fact, federal involvement in them is a dangerous intrusion. The states are not required to acquiesce to the whims of any president or any committee he may literally write into existence without regard for the Constitution. The states have rights, including the right to say no. And in this case, they should say no. President Trump went to Twitter, as is his habit, to ask what the refusing states have to hide. Frankly, they have the same sort of things to hide that citizens do when we oppose gun registries or warrantless wiretaps. Things that are simply none of Washington's business. Claims that the information is public and therefore should be handed over don't hold water either. This is about grandstanding, political theater for the president to proclaim himself ruler of the states, a role that is not supported by the Constitution. It's just a childish power trip. For Georgia specifically, the information being handed over is fortunately limited. But frankly, I'd like to see more spine out of our conservative leaders like the defiance Governor Nathan Deal showed to the Medicare expansion. Such defiance was right thing then, and it would have been the right thing now.
That's Sam Burnham, curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. Just ahead, the break room mixes it up. But first, more lives are lost to gun violence in Savannah. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Over the holiday weekend, three people in Savannah were killed after a shooting and a car crash.
A night of violence in downtown Savannah.
Just heard about 7 to 10 shots ring out, and at that point, I just laid down.
Two shootings and a deadly crash near City Market hours after Independence Day celebrations come to an end.
Several others were injured. One of the people killed was Scott Waldrop, general manager of The Gray. It's a popular restaurant where we did a live broadcast earlier this year. In a statement, the restaurant says Waldrop was, quote, part of the very soul of who we are and what we do. His contributions were exponential because of the purity and generosity of his spirit. Those of us who knew him are truly lucky and infinitely better people for having had him for far too short a time in our lives, end quote. Meanwhile, WTOC-TV in Savannah reports witnesses say Waldrop died a hero as he pushed people to safety. 17-year-old Jerry Chambers Jr. was arrested for the shooting. He faces 3 counts of felony murder charges. Savannah police have identified Chambers as a gang member. And this isn't an isolated incident. Savannah has one of the highest murder rates in Georgia, and that rate increased by nearly 70% in 2015. In a news conference this week, Savannah Police Chief Joseph Lumpkin says gang violence must stop.
We have to hit them all over town. We also have to stop them where they are. If we don't stop them in their block, they will be in your block. So we have to have the resources to actually stop them.
Last year, Chief Lumpkin spoke to GPB about the struggle to find good police officers.
Many good officers probably left because they didn't like what was occurring. We have authorized 605 positions sworn. But the former human resource director told me that we had not been at full staff in over 15 years.
I talked about this last year with Frederick Green. At the time, he was support and outreach coordinator for the End Gun Violence Initiative in Savannah. I began by asking why citizens need to step in to address the violence.
Because it's a community affair, it's a community issue, and the community needs to step in order to help address the problem. A lot of the individuals who may be perpetrating these crimes live within our community, live within the homes. So therefore, the community has to address the problem.
Frederick, here is a clip of Detective Robert Sambutoro of the Violent Crimes Unit. This is from a video from the End Gun Violence Initiative. He's talking about the lack of communication between the public and law enforcement.
Everybody's afraid that something's going to happen to them, or they're afraid of going to court, or I don't know where the fear comes in, but I think it's a lot of fear and it's a lot of just kind of not knowing. For me as an investigator, that's the most difficult thing of my job. It's not interviewing suspects, it's not the investigation itself, it's not evidence, it's convincing witnesses to tell us what they saw.
He says he doesn't know where the fear comes from. Do you?
Well, I can't say that I really exactly know where the fear comes from. Nationwide, there's a disconnect between law enforcement and the community. There's a lot of distrust. So a part of my reach is the outreach. Part of my job as the outreach and support coordinator is to try to bridge those gaps. Part of the model that we follow is to bridge the gap between law enforcement, social service agencies, community providers, as well as the community, and try to gain the trust of individuals in the community and let them know that there is help there for you.
Well, that sounds great, except how do you do that?
Well, one of the things that we do as following the model is that with the EGV group
and gun violence
group violence intervention model, back in the early 80s, David Kennedy started this coalition between law enforcement, community providers, social service agencies, and they just got out into the community. They engaged the community and began to find out what the needs were in the community. At the same time, in Boston, a pastor by the name of Eugene Rivers began to do what he called the 10-point coalition. So he got area pastors together who would go out into the community, not so much to proselytize, but to go into the community and engage the community, find out what their needs was, assess it. So they were responsible for what we call the Boston Miracle. The homicide rate reduced from about 200 a year to about 20 to 30. So it was a significant decrease in homicides in Boston. Well, cities all throughout the nation have adopted this model. And so we have adopted it also. In some cities, they would call it Project Ceasefire. Here, we call it End Gun Violence. So what we're doing is we're taking that recipe, that model, and we are trying to say we've met with pastors within the community. I began to engage community leaders or neighborhood associate heads and begin to get ideas, not only educate them about what the initiative is about, but also get ideas from them on how we can get into the community and be able to offer this help, this social service component.
That was Frederick Green speaking with me about gun violence in Savannah. When we spoke last year, Green was support and outreach coordinator for the End Gun Violence Initiative in Savannah. So it has been a long week. Remember, it was only 4th of July on Tuesday. There were fireworks, barbecue, travel bans, and more fun with Twitter, of course. So as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, take a breath, think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
Trump supporters were not too pleased after NPR tweeted out the Declaration of Independence in bits and pieces.
This contest is the greatest event of the summer. It's the Independence Day holiday out here in Coney Island and across America. And Joey Chestnut is the great unifier right there in the center of the table.
In the end, the fact that this is resolved and the changes that we've made will be what people will remember, not some of the BS kind of gotcha journalism.
Joining us in the break room is psychology professor Roxanne Donovan of Kennesaw State University, writer and blogger Jessica Salaji, Rule Joiner, who owns the store 24E in Savannah, and HB Cho, reporter for Korean Daily. Everyone, welcome to Friday.
Morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with the Declaration of Independence. It's part of an annual tradition at NPR. On Tuesday, they not only read the Declaration of Independence, but then tweeted it out 140 characters at a time. That's been going on for 29 years. Here's a clip from the broadcast of it. You hear NPR's David Green.
Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
So those words did not sit all that well with some people. They thought those words from the Declaration of Independence were meant to trash President Trump. So now that we've had a little time to be surprised by this news, what do we think is actually going on here? Let's start with you down there in Savannah. Jessica or Rule, you want to tackle this?
I just think it shows how low we've sunken on the political, like, positive meter, that people think that this is what's, you know, these are the things that are offensive. And I think that it shows the Trump supporters who they really are, that they say that they supported him because he upholds the Constitution and all these founding beliefs, but they don't even know what the founding beliefs are. They can't even identify them in a tweet.
Brule?
Well, I think if you
put Jesus at Bull and Broughton Street and he was giving out $100 bills, you're going to offend some people. So, you know, I just pass him a glass of tea.
HP.
Yeah, Mike Pence should start tweeting some Bible verses and see what happens.
Well, it depends on which Bible verses you tweet.
There are a lot to be upset about, right?
Yeah. Roxanne?
I just shake my head with this. It's so sad, and it's sad on two accounts. The first, my partner is a political scientist, and he teaches intro to government, and he's always lamenting about how people just don't understand political, don't understand politics, and they don't have political knowledge, at least to the level that is necessary to be a citizen voting in our country. But where are we right now that we demonize the other if they don't believe what we believe, or we don't think they believe what we believe? And there's this idea that media is hyperliberal, that NPR is hyperliberal, and the reaction from people who believe this to think ill without information just is sad to me. Our level of conversation and connection has really gone down.
I think it's all in the lens that you look at this. I mean, you know, me as a I'm fearlessly patriotic. I think it's great that you're saying it. And if someone gets offended by it, you know, why do we react to it? Why are we even talking about it right now? Who cares? You know, it's the Constitution. If you don't want to hear it, turn the channel.
It was the Declaration, but the point taken.
Yeah.
I wonder how many people would anyone of any political persuasion would recognize the Declaration of Independence, 140 characters at that time. Roxanne is ready to jump in on that, but let's talk about something else. To mark Independence Day, President Trump pledged to support the nation's military.
The story of America's men and women in uniform is the story of freedom and overcoming oppression, the strong protecting the weak, and the good defeating evil.
So while the president honored the U.S. on Independence Day, he's being criticized by some for not honoring other celebrations. For example, for the first time in nearly two decades, the White House did not host an iftar dinner to commemorate Ramadan. Actually, that was Ramadan was first marked, I think, under Jefferson. President Trump also did not celebrate Pride Month. So the question for me here, and some people are saying he hasn't visited California yet either, but look, does presidential participation in observances like these, does it really matter? Is it just all show?
I think so past presidents who have always kind of recognize this Ramadan or Pride Month, how genuine were they? I'm not so sure. And when it comes to Trump, I think he's just being honest to his natural tendencies. I don't think he has tried to represent all Americans who, as he said he will, and why should he?
Right, he said he was going to upend tradition, right?
Right, and so he's gotten this far by upending everything that he could and being just brutally honest when it comes to what he sees important and what he sees unimportant.
But he's not some regular guy. He's the president of the United States, and we're a nation of diversity. And he can't just look at one sect of people and say, these are my people, and everyone else doesn't count. So is it genuine? I think many presidents who did this, it wasn't genuine in their beliefs, given their rhetoric and the policies that they wanted to create. But I think it's an important symbolism that represents an ideal that we are a diverse nation and everyone deserves to be seen, heard, and valued. And it's an ideal. We don't necessarily always live up to that. But I think the president should embody that ideal.
Jessica, what do you think here?
Well, I think the first part about California is ridiculous because I looked up his travel schedule and he hasn't been west of Iowa since he was elected. So there's plenty of states he hasn't been to. But as far as the Pride Month and Ramadan, you know, I think that even if he did recognize it, that he would be criticized for not recognizing it enough or properly or in the way that people thought. I think the fact that he just didn't do it at all is probably the safest move he could have made. But whether you think it's right or wrong.
Rule?
I sort of echo Jessica's sentiments, but at the end of the day, you know, this president, he's already won. He won the election, and he needs to start to transition into bringing people together. So no longer is he an activist. He's now a representative of all of us. And we need to find people or at least, you know, promote him or somebody in his corner needs to tell him that, hey, it's time for reconciliation. It's time to bring this country together. And, I think if I were president, I would be attending those events.
Maybe that's an announcement by Roel Joyner of Savannah. We only have about 4 minutes to talk about the next thing, but I have a feeling we might need more time than that. So let's talk about the video that the president tweeted over the holiday weekend. He forwarded a video that showed him as a wrestler body slamming a guy who had a CNN logo for a head. The Reddit user who originally created that video apologized for the post, as well as a dizzying number of many racist posts that were on Reddit. CNN chose not to release that Reddit user's name because he's a private citizen who they say showed remorse and promised not to do it again. The network says it, quote, reserves the right to publish his identity should any of that change, end quote. What do we make of this? And let's start with you, Roxanne. What do you think?
I don't think it's okay that CNN held back his name. I think, or her name, their name.
It's been released that it's a middle-aged guy.
Right. Yes. So the only way that I would have been okay with this is if it was a minor. I think this cloak of anonymity online causes cyberbullying, or at least contributes greatly to it, because people don't feel that they're held accountable. There's even a name for it, online disinhibition effect. And I don't know why CNN is holding it back. If it were a policy of CNN to hold back everyone's name if they're a private citizen and they're repentant, then okay, I get it.
Yeah,
it's CNN's
policy.
But it's so not their policy, so why in this case are they giving this person a pass?
Jessica?
In Savannah call those keyboard warriors.
That's a nice way to put it. Do you think, Jessica, do you or Rule, do you think it was okay for CNN to hold it back, or this warning that they would change that decision if he keeps posting racist things?
I mean, they're a private company. They can do whatever they want. But I think I kind of echo what was said earlier that, you know, they've had a lot of faux pas lately, and perhaps that they could have restored a little integrity by releasing and kind of acknowledging, hey, this is the person that we're going to throw under the bus for this incident, instead of, you know, saying that we're going to continue to monitor the situation and then maybe we'll release it later on. I don't think that was a good move for them.
Yeah, that was a little odd.
I think I found it odd that they went in so far to finding who he is. I think obviously did it, but then making a big deal out of making an article about his identity. I think that's a little misguided, because why should he apologize, not Trump? He's a private Reddit, he's a troll. He's an internet troll. That's what he does. And is anybody surprised that he has said a lot of racist or anti-Semite things in the past? Nobody's surprised. So what I think the only kind of person who has something to apologize for, I think, is the public official that we have in the White House.
It is Friday. We are hanging out in the break room. Ahead, we're going to talk about the New Jersey governor getting scalded over his day at the beach. And could Hollywood finally be seeing an end to pay inequities? This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. We are having some coffee and conversation in the break room. That's what we do on Fridays. My guests are H.B. Cho of the Korean Daily, Rule Joyner, who owns the store 24E in Savannah, and I've heard is thinking about running for president, writer and blogger Jessica Szilagyi, and psychology professor Roxanne Donovan of Kennesaw State University. A big thank you to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that we drink, and you can find them online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay, it's been too rainy here for a beach trip, but a lot of people went to the beach on the 4th. Not in New Jersey. That's because beaches were closed. Public beaches were closed. There's a dispute over the state budget. The governor closed all public places, including the beaches. But he himself, Chris Christie, enjoyed the day at the beach with his family and friends. Christie says he had a right to use the beach because it's part of an official Oceanside governor's residence.
I wasn't sitting next to a 25-year-old blonde. I was sitting next to my wife of 31 years, surrounded by my children and some of their best friends. If that's a scandal, that's a scandal I'm guilty of every day of my life.
Only 15% of Jersey's population actually approves of Governor Chris Christie. So is his political career toast, and did Beachgate seal it?
Yes. Well, I think his political career was already over, or he wouldn't have done it, because anyone who gives a flip about what their constituents think would never do something like that. These rules for thee and not for me. I mean, he looks ridiculous, and 15% I think is 15% approval is a lot considering his arrogance.
I actually disagree, because I think Christie is doing what politicians do circa 2017. He just needs to find a better state to do it in. And I think, you know, come down to old Georgia, and people are gonna are willing to overlook hypocrisy as long as their politicians make them feel like it's back in 1950.
Wow. The headline, Georgia willing to overlook hypocrisy in its politicians. Rule?
You know, I think Mr. Christie's going to have a lot more time to spend on the beach soon.
Okay, fair enough. Closed or not, although if he's not governor anymore, he can't go to can't enjoy that governor's residence. What do you think?
You can look at the past election with the presidential election. People are ready to hold people accountable. They're ready for leadership that represents themselves. They want equanimity. They want people to be treated equally. I think the guy's toast.
Roxanne?
I don't know. Hypocrisy, thinks the rules don't apply to him. Maybe if he runs for president again, he'll be more successful.
Come on now. This is a tough crowd. All right. There was a problem with where they shoot the popular TV show Hawaii Five-0.
We're on an island with less than a million people, which means the bad guys know the good guys. So we need to look outside the box.
That is the very popular actor, Daniel Dae Kim. He played Detective Lieutenant Chin Ho-kelly. Grace Park played his cousin Kono, who is also a police officer. The two actors asked CBS to pay them what they were paying their white co-stars. But CBS said no, because they were considered to be in supporting roles. So Daniel Dae Kim and Grace Park said goodbye. So do we agree with CBS's reasoning on pay inequality here? Supporting roles, you get paid less.
I think that when it comes to individual contracts, I think I can see why. Because my understanding is their kind of portion in the storyline isn't as prominent as the other two actors that are being compared, that their salaries are being compared to. But there are, you know, you can see why they, although it's shot in Hawaii, and
why are two white people the stars of Hawaii Five-0?
That's the bigger question,
I think that's the
right?
Structural kind of larger question. But then when it comes to individual contracts, and you can see why CBS is making that argument. And I don't know if this issue rises to a level of kind of social injustice, but I think they took a good strategy by walking out and then making it, letting it become an issue.
Right.
Hot topic.
That appears to be their goal. What what do you think, Rule?
I think they should bring back Crockett and Tubbs.
From Miami Vice, as you're talking about. You're showing your age here, Rule. people wear socks with their loafers now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the market dictates the contracts, and if they were highly sought after, you know, no matter what their ethnicity is, they would have been paid more. So the market will correct that. You know, I think we're beginning to get a little bit hypersensitive to things, but I do. I imagine, though, that with this controversy that's come through and the notoriety from it, they'll probably get some better contracts down the road.
Roxanne, you want to weigh in here?
I agree with HB. There's a larger issue here that needs to be addressed, and that is why so many leading figures in Hollywood are white, even when the show is in a place that is predominantly Asian and indigenous people live there. So I'm wondering why, but that's a big question. These actors did what they could to bring the issue to the forefront, and I admire their activism. I don't know if it's going to change the way Hollywood pays actors based on gender and race, but I think they did what they could within their sphere of influence, and that kind of activism I find really inspiring.
We have a tweet from Sam Burnham who says, yes, Crockett and Tubbs.
Oh, dear.
Jessica, you want to weigh in?
I'm just surprised, and it continues to surprise me, that we've become so bold in talking about other people's salaries. Because, you know, we didn't used to know what our coworkers made. We didn't used to demand things like this. And I think it just speaks to where we've come, even in, you know, private industries, that we demand that we are in the know about what other people are making.
Wait, are you saying that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Personally, I just think it's a weird thing. I would never ask what my coworkers are making. I mean, I as long as I believe I'm making what I'm worth, I think that's the end of the story.
I would love to get listeners' views on that. Let me know if you think we should know what other people make and whether we're making equal to someone doing the same work. It's a fair question. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or do what Sam Burnham did and tweet us at OST Talk. All right, so let's move on to American land. We like to think of America, the space between the East and West Coast, as American land.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island.
You might be surprised, though, to know who actually some of this land belongs to. According to the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, Georgia is one of a few states in which more than 1 million acres of our land is owned by foreign entities. Some of the countries that hold Peach State acreage include Liechtenstein, Saudi Arabia, Australia, and the Cayman Islands. What do we think about this?
A lot of these companies own our agricultural land, and that makes me nervous because when you own so much land, your lobbying efforts are going to be very strong. And it makes me very nervous about whether local citizens, whether their ideas, rights will be upheld if foreign companies are lobbying our government officials.
Well, most of these companies are cutting down the trees and taking the timber or mining.
Right. So environmental laws come to mind as something these lobbyists may be fighting
trying
against.
Trying to influence.
Yes.
Jessica?
I kind of sort of agree, but at the same time, my concern is just what they're doing with it. You know, timber is like our number one industry other than outside of quote agriculture and poultry. And I think that, you know, we should be concerned over how they're using it, not necessarily because of their lobbying efforts, but because timber farms and farming in general is on the decline. We lose millions of acres in farmland every year, and our population continues to skyrocket. And I don't think people take those types of things into consideration when they think about who owns it and what their plans are to do with it after they've gotten their money's worth.
Rule?
I'm really conflicted on this. I'm all for foreign investment, but once again, you know, what are best practices of other countries that you see that have similar issues? Can you go down to Mexico and buy all the property down there? Can you even go to China and buy some of their factories? You can invest in it. You can have people that are indigenous or live in those areas to be part of that venture. So I don't really know how I feel about it, but I do know that the world is, you know, like Tom Friedman would say, it's hot, flat, and crowded, and getting hotter. So these are issues that are going to be important to us in the very near future.
I should just mention that Tom Friedman, I assume you're referring to the journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner. Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. HB?
I don't have any reason to think foreign companies are going to do anything different when they own American land than American companies or even Georgian companies owning the same land. I think it's largely similar to foreign auto manufacturing companies buying land and building factories here and producing their cars here, because that's more marketable. You know, that's a resource that America has and that foreigners are willing to buy and invest in. So I don't really see a huge problem here, unless you know, stats show that they are doing something, you know,
wrong.
Menacing.
Right.
Right.
We did get a tweet about an earlier topic that we discussed. Rabbit was talking about knowing other people's pay and says, yes, we should know what others are making for the same work. Unequal pay for some groups leads to systemic inequity. You know how to weigh in and become part of our break room. Just tweet us like Rabbit did at OST Talk or post on Facebook. We are in the break room with psychology professor Roxanne Donovan of Kennesaw State, writer and blogger Jessica Salaji, Rule Joyner, who owns the store 24E in Savannah, and HB Cho of the Korean Daily. All right. Let's face it, not everybody is cut out to be a parent.
Neon, please try not to step on the children.
Okay, all right.
Turns out there were fewer births in the U.S. last year than in any other year. Researchers with the National Center for Health Statistics say birth rates declined to record lows in all groups under the age of 30. Among women ages 20 to 24, the decline was 4%. For women 25 to 29, that rate fell 2%. So why are fewer people having kids?
Because it's so expensive. I mean, the care during pregnancy, the actual childbirth, whether you have insurance or not, and then actually raising a child. And then it doesn't even sound that fun after you have them. So, I mean, I just, all that money, and then it's a lot of work.
It's fun. It's also awful, but fun.
I think there are too many cute cat photos online. People are getting their cute fix online and not having to.
Interesting hypothesis.
I think many of these people are in debt and they can't imagine spending more money on kids. But also, if you look around and you look at the political instability, the wars, the overpopulation, I mean, it's a rational choice to decide to be childless at this moment, historically.
Rule?
I've been begging my wife to have another one. Do you hear this, Delaine Joyner? One more. She's against it, so I told her it'd have to be the next wife.
Oh, no.
That's, she knows I'm kidding.
Complaints at rulejoyner.com.
She knows I'm kidding.
You better hope.
Love you, honey.
All right. Moving on, let's talk about T-shirts. Reality TV stars Kylie and Kendall Jenner have since apologized for selling T-shirts in which their faces were superimposed on the images of music legends like Ozzy Osbourne, Pink Floyd, Metallica, and Tupac Shakur. The T-shirts cost $125. People say it was in poor taste and overpriced, including Ozzy Osbourne's wife, Sharon. But they have the right to do it. I mean, we may not buy the T-shirt, but does that make it wrong?
Do they have the right to do it? Don't they have to have licensing agreements with the...
A number of musicians actually filed for, you know, for cease and desist, but that is still a legal question. Yeah.
Okay, so whether or not they have a right to do it, it is in poor taste. And after the whole Pepsi commercial debacle...
With Kendall Jenner solving racism with the Pepsi?
Right.
That one you're talking about?
Yeah. I would think they would be really cautious about co-opting Black culture. So the fact that they used Tupac and Biggie's image, I'm like, really? Could you have made a better decision?
The Pepsi commercial made Kendall Jenner any less popular? I don't think so. I didn't know about her before that, and through this, you know, quote unquote controversy, I learned that her stepsister's name is Kylie. So for me, when it comes to getting their names out, I think it's done the job for me.
Like, oh, because you already know it. Yeah.
So anything for a profit.
Anything that's gonna make a noise, anything that's gonna get, you know, on second thought, talk about this. I think it's a success, a free marketing.
Savannah, you guys want to comment here?
I don't know who would pay $125 for a T-shirt in general, let alone one with the Jenners
That's
on it.
My but thought.
I was so
yes,
there myself.
Absolutely, I agree. All right, well, let's talk about how much you would pay for a hot dog. Competitive eater Joey Chestnut set a new world's record on the 4th of July. He ate 72 hot dogs in 10 minutes. Here's ESPN with the competition.
It's tough for these guys. I mean, Chestnut has such efficient delivery. The two meats, the two buns, a little bit of water. It's just an incredible delivery system. Jeff Bezos should take note.
Jeff Bezos of Amazon there. All right. How many hot dogs do you think, realistically, could you eat in 10 minutes' time? Let's be honest here.
One. And that's the only one I'd want to eat in 10 minutes' time. This is so gross. He consumed over 20,000 calories in 10 minutes. I can't imagine the sodium. I can't imagine the chemicals he just put in his body in 10 minutes. That is gross.
Okay, but Rule, how many hot dogs do you think you could eat in one sitting?
I'm still outraged that Kylie Jenner co-opted a rock god's image. She could not even carry Ozzy Osbourne's jock strap, but I agree. I think the whole hot dog thing is sort of excessive. But hey, if you like hot dogs, get at it.
72 of them.
Are you saying you don't eat hot dogs?
You know, I it, it's It's not my thing. My kids love it, but I'm just sort of grossed out. I know what they're made of, and
oh, see, that's the problem. You're not supposed to think about that. Jessica, how many hot dogs can you eat?
I'm not going to try to race to eat anything. Like, I want to enjoy my food, and I don't want to have too much of it so that I never want to eat it again. I mean, that just sounds like you're ruining things that would be delicious normally.
Yeah, I agree. HB, how many hot dogs can you eat?
Pay me enough. I can handle, like, 15.
Wow, 15 in 10 minutes.
I'm pretty sure, yeah. I mean, pay me enough, then that's the condition. But
I'll give you $5 if you can video it. All right, this is a good question for our listeners, though. How many hot dogs do you think you could eat? Look, if you're vegan, I will include vegan hot dogs in there also as well. But just let us know what you think your total could be. And if you do test this out just to find a number, we want video or it didn't happen. That's the end of the break room. I want to say thank you to our guest. Rule Joyner owns the store 24E in Savannah.
Thank you.
Writer and blogger Jessica Szilagyi, psychology professor Roxanne Donovan of Kennesaw State, and HB Cho of the Korean Daily. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
And that's it for today and for the week. You know how to reach us, Facebook or tweet us at OST Talk, or just leave us a message. The phone number is 404-500-9457. This on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great weekend.